We're shipping Mother's Day gifts with a rapid-fire round of questions. Ready?
Yes, my gift. Can you pack it?
Yep.
Ship it?
Yes.
Guarantee it?
Of course.
Oh, send gift baskets?
For sure.
Protect electronics? Dog-proof it? Return it if they hate it?
Yes, no, and yeah.
Are you the UPS store?
Hey, we have a winner!
Visit theupsstore.com/guarantee for full details. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, prices, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS Store. Visit a store today.
I'm your host, Al Cooley, of the Ghost in the Valley podcast. Today we have B.B. Griffith. He is from Denver, Colorado. He is the author of numerous excellent books, and I am reading a series of three right now, the Vanished series. And also he has the Gordon Pope Thrillers, which is another series, the Tournament Books, another series, Witch of the Water, Las Vegas Luck Magic. This is an honor for me to have B.B. Griffith on the show today. We'll be right back after these brief messages with my interview with B.B. Griffith.
Do you have a ghost story to share? A UFO encounter? Bigfoot? Whatever your paranormal experience is, you can share it on Ghosts in the Valley podcast. Email cooley54@gmail.com. Ghosts in the Valley podcast.
Today we have B.B. Griffith on the show. He is the author of many books.
Thanks for having me, Al. I appreciate it. Good to be here.
I came across your book, Follow the Crow, and my sister's an avid book reader, and she passes down all her books she reads to everybody around her that she thinks would be interested in a book she reads, you know. So she gave me Follow the Crow, Beyond the Veil, and The Coyote Way. And I've read Follow the Crow, and I'm halfway through Beyond the Veil. I haven't got the Coyote Way yet, but
I hope you do.
Oh, my God, they're excellent. Before we go into the other books, I mean, is The Coyote Way, is this the last of that series? Or
yeah, it's not the last of the series. You know, I've written several books across various spectrums of what you would probably call thriller, right? But the supernatural thrillers that I write far and away seem to be the most quote-unquote crowd-pleasing. And I get more letters, I get more emails about this series, you know, the Vanished series, which starts with Follow the Crow, than I do any of my other books that I've written. So that tells me something needs to keep going. So I've got another couple in the works.
Yeah, fantastic. Because I see you had a little pattern going on there, like 2014, 2015, and 2016. So there'll be a little span there between the next one.
I went back to another series. I do basically what you're not supposed to do when you write books, which is I juggle three different series at once. I'll kind of move back and forth when really what you're supposed to do is keep the momentum going. But with this Vanished series, I'm blessed enough to have readers continue to find it and continue to clamor for it. And I'm really excited to get going on this fourth book too. Once I settle a few other things with the others.
Yeah. My wife was asking me, you know, what does this have to do with the paranormal? You know, I said, well, you have to read the book. So she's going to start Follow the Crow, I think, next, after she gets done with her next book. There's stuff in there that the Native American Indian and the spirits they worship and honor. And it's amazing to me with all the episodes I've done on my podcast. Sometimes one way or another, something refers back to the Native American Indian.
Right. Yeah. And I grew up in Colorado, and New Mexico is a very close place to my heart, where a lot of Native Americans, particularly the Navajo, call that area home. And I have been particularly fascinated by the way that the Navajo really stand out in the way that they've documented their, you know, spiritualistic aspect. They were descendants of farmers, right? They have a very close relationship with the land and with the, what I call like the thin spaces of the world. And they have a very interesting way, a very non-Western way of explaining a lot of strange things that really resonated with me and, you know, is the reason that I wrote the book. And not only with me, though, it seems to resonate with all of my readers, which really tells me that there is far more than just a kernel of truth in there, right? That there's something that speaks to all of us, you know, very deeply, even, you know, native, non-native, is something that spans that entire spectrum.
Well, I thought it was interesting, you know, that everything had a spirit, you know, and
mm-hmm. Really kind of what spurred all of my work with Vanished is this notion that in the Western world, we have a linear way of thinking. You progress from a start to an end, right? You're born and then you die, and that's your span. But the Navajo way is circular. And everything that was comes again, and everything that is has a meaning that's deeper than what you may initially be thinking, right? And that is a great well of fiction writing, right? And of course, I do take liberties, and it's well researched, but I'm creating a fiction realm around these base characters, which are the coyote, you know, which is a major archetype in the Navajo belief system. But I just think that they have such a way of explaining that everything that you're looking at has a surface value, and then it has a much deeper value. And that's where that supernatural aspect comes in.
I don't know if you've seen Skinwalker Ranch. They're talking about not digging because, you know, that's sacred ground.
Yeah. A skinwalker, you know, we have, as we always do, we appropriate these things, right? But a skinwalker is a very serious, bad, bad thing mm-hmm. in the Navajo belief system. And to the extent where they won't utter the word, right? Because even by uttering the word, you might, you know, draw attention to yourself. And what's interesting is that often, and in the stories that I write, skinwalkers are infectious. So you might not know. In fact, historically, and in some instances with some of the of my inspirations, you know, Tony Hillerman and some of these others, where you have just like a bit of bone in the mouth, and that's all that it takes to turn you into a skinwalker. So that's part of where I think the terror comes from. It could be anybody. It was the original, the thing, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of, it could be anyone you're looking at that is this ultra nefarious, powerful, you know, negative being.
Follow the Crew was absolutely phenomenal. I really like the Beyond the Veil because you take it to a different area. I was thinking, how are you going to do these characters from book to book? And I like the way it starts out with a whole different character.
So each of these books is, is told in first person present, which is a very, I think, unique way of telling a story. And people told me would never be well received. And there you go. It's my most well received of any of my series. But it's tough to tell, I think, a story in a split narrative where every chapter is a different person or is told from the voice, the present voice of a different person. And, you know, Follow the Crow had a start to finish narrative, but I wanted to go beyond the veil of death, right? Which I have visualized as sort of a physical curtain. What that might look like in what I have read and researched as a strongly Navajo tilt, right? Which is as a river where there is no good or bad. There's only peace and chaos. And, you know, good and bad is a very Western way of, I think, labeling, you know, spiritualism. You're either a good person or a bad person. But I found in my research of the Native Americans that it's less about what's good and what's bad and more about what is peaceful and what is chaotic, and that both have a place in the world. And ultimately, you're going to be asked where you feel most comfortable. Do you feel most comfortable on the peaceful side or on the chaotic side? And that's kind of where you're going to settle, right? And I wanted to depict that in fiction. And so that's what that Beyond the Veil is about.
Yeah, well, we're going to get back to Follow the Crow because I have a story for you there that happened to myself reading your book. But I'm going to get into the Gordon Pope thrillers. That's another three-part series?
Yes, this is a three-part series that is what I would call a psychological thriller that follows the life and trials of a child psychiatrist that's trying to help children in Baltimore, which is a, you know, very rundown, difficult area in a lot of places that I know from personal experience and our family does here. My wife is a nurse that was educated at Johns Hopkins, which is very illustrious school in a very rundown area. And Baltimore's just difficult, but very rich culturally and very rich, I think, spiritually. And there are a lot of kids there that I think are dealing with a city that is in some disrepair. And The Sleepwalkers, which is the first book in that series, is also fairly paranormal in that what it talks about is dreams. And the whole premise is if you can commit a crime in your sleep and what dreams mean and how they tap into kind of an ancient system in our bodies that might harken back to sort of like a Jungian, very primitive and primal instinct and what that might mean. And that seems to have tapped into a lot of my readers. They like that one too.
I'm doing an episode in the summer. It's going to be based on dreams. Really interested in reading that one.
Yeah, Mind Games, which is each of them follows a character that has a very significant mental disorder. And I had to be very careful to treat those respectfully, right? Because that's something that, unfortunately, in the United States, we just see so much of, right? But schizophrenia and then psychopathy what was interesting about the Sleepwalkers was, and the whole point that I had behind it was that nobody really knows what dreams are. You know, we've invested millions in, and we have the brightest minds in medicine and in psychiatry and in psychology, and no one really still really understands what the point of them are and why you sort of start to remember them at a certain age and why you have lucid dreams sometimes and other times you're carried on for the ride. It's a very strange thing that happens in our brain that not a lot of people understand. And I just think it's a great space to explore in fiction.
And that leads you into Shadowland?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Shadowland is the third in my series where my protagonist, Gordon Pope, has his entire career been battling a very difficult child's, like juvenile psychiatric center where kids are mistreated. He's a champion of children. No matter what, you know, you've done, you always are given the benefit of the doubt by Gordon Pope. And in Shadowland, he really comes to a head trying to fight a system of incarceration for children that he sees as evil. And his alternative is himself, which is just very open one-on-one understanding of children. And I released that one. That was my most recent release. And it's done very well. People have really liked it. What's interesting though is that I kind of veered in that series into, I guess, what you might call more hard-boiled thriller. And a lot of the people who first read The Sleepwalkers, which I think is probably the most ephemeral of all of them, are like, where's the weird Jungian stuff? Give me more of that. So I always take the feedback on my readers, and I'm looking forward to kind of delving into more of the weirdness of the mind again with the Gordon Pope stuff.
Yeah, there's nothing better than positive criticism.
That's right.
But, you know, getting to the sleepwalkers, you know, and dreaming, and one psychic told me she gets her visions from some of her dreams. And she told me the dangers of a dream inside of a dream. When you're dreaming and then you're dreaming, you're inside that dream, that how dangerous that is. Mm-hmm. And then when you have a dream inside of a dream inside of a dream.
Yeah, it's like an Inception. You're kind of getting too deep.
It's almost hard to get out of that.
Right. The whole Gordon Pope series came about because people can't explain that humans have the same types of dreams. Uh-huh. It doesn't matter who you are. They have the same types of dreams with the same issues and the same colors and a lot of the same things that happen, right? In terms of like falling or what red means or stuff like that. And no one really knows how that happened. And to me, that is an unexplainable that we live with every day and people don't really delve into it because there's no way to figure it out. So that's kind of why the Sleepwalkers came about.
The tournament books, mm-hmm. you know, the Blue Fall, Gray Winter, mm-hmm. Black Spring, and Summer Crush.
That's right. So this series is what I would call sort of a sci-fi dystopian. And so it's about in the near future, an underground tournament that decides major political and major financial worldwide decisions, like controls the fate and fortune of millions. And it's fought by, you know, it's like a war game situation, nation state actors, where they put three against three. And it's a much quicker, cleaner way of deciding a Cold War or deciding a real war than what we have right now. Mm-hmm. But again, it goes back to like there's a world just beneath the world you're looking at where the decisions and the things that happen, you know, and I say specifically in the tournament, I think I referenced at the time I was writing, we had a big issue with the base in Okinawa where our government wanted soldiers there, the Japanese government didn't. And that was settled at some point over a weekend. And I thought, how could that be settled so quickly? And we all kind of took it for granted that, yeah, they figured it out at a diplomatic level. But what if perhaps there was something else going on that settled that? And it could have been like a game of cards. It could have been like a rock, paper, scissors, or it could have been like this underground area, this underground tournament that solves not only that, but a ton of our problems that we just assume go away. None of it really goes away. So that's where the tournament came
from. I love the way you have, they all have a season, you know.
I wrote three of them and I was like, oh, heavens, this is a complete cycle. And I have the tournament trilogy, but then I thought, oh, I can't leave summer out. So I came in and wrote Summer Crush, which I think is the strongest of all four, ironically. But
online, I see there was a trilogy, you know, for three of them. I said, where did Summer Crush come from? You know, like, oh, there was another one added, you know?
You can't have three seasons. No. There's four.
Right, like what happened to summer?
And I would get notes from readers like, hey, you can't. And you can't have started the seasons and then not end the seasons.
Well, I was looking at when I first seen the trilogy, you know, like, okay, there's fall, there's winter, there's spring. Oh, where's summer?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's exactly what I heard.
Witch of the Water.
Yeah. So Witch of the Water is perhaps the most personal book that I've written. I have a 4-year-old son that I love very dearly. He's our only child. He was born with congenital heart defects that for a long time he was struggling. And for a long time he was what they called a failure to thrive, which I think is a doctor's nice way of saying that this child's got a low percentage chance of making it. And he was on oxygen and we were going through multiple heart surgeries. And the only way I could get away from all that was to write a book. And I didn't have a whole book in me. And I was feeling, as you may imagine, fairly dark mm-hmm. at that time. But I did have a story about a boy who was tasked with an enormous task, which in the book is keeping the lighthouses lit in order to keep a monster at bay. Mm-hmm. And that's an adaptation of a Highlands legend. The whole book takes place in the turn of the century Scotland, the northern Highlands region. And I kind of put my boy in this boy's shoes, where he suffers, you know, some losses, and some he's having to deal with his family and what his lot in life is, and just has to put one foot in front of the next and continue to walk forward. And at the end is this enormous witch, right? This witch of the waters, the kind of the last stumbling block he has to get through in order to really live his life. And I think that's kind of a direct I didn't know it at the time, a direct representation of what was his open heart surgery, which was we were all trying to get through in our own way. And he was 7 months, he was 6 months old. He couldn't have known this, and he still doesn't know, thank God, because you have that selective memory about difficult times. But it ended up being, I think, a very powerful, concise punch of a novella that has struck a lot of people. And that actually I get outside of the Vanished series, I get more requests for follow-ups there than I do any of my other books. It's incredible. But a few things stuck with me that also helped to inspire the writing, which was, so he had open heart surgery. They sent us home with Advil, and he was fine after, I think, 24 hours. I mean, they had the adhesive across the big zipper, mm-hmm. but he was fine. And he said, and they said, with children, young children who don't understand what's happening, they do not associate pain or any of this with death. And that's why they recover like gangbusters, right? It's us. Only we associate pain with death and have a fear factor involved. And he just didn't have that. He just assumed, I mean, it's kind of heartbreaking. He assumed this was course of life. Everybody went through an open heart surgery, maybe at 6 months. It's just part of the rite of passage, right? But it's only us that there's this span of our life where we just don't associate any of that. And so much of that power is mental, and you can just blow through a lot of things that would, quite frankly, kill an older person, because it just, those associations aren't there yet. And that's fascinating to me.
You had one book here, Las Vegas Luck Magic. Is that your latest?
That's my latest of my new series, that it focuses on a guy who ends up in a life-threatening car wreck and wakes up with the ability to see luck. He sees it as like floating dust that moves around the world, and he can subtly influence it, but it has its own mind and it has its own agenda. So naturally, he goes to Vegas to try to get to the root of it, because Vegas is the land of luck. It was written around that time where we were struggling with our son. And it's a way that I think I had a main character who I really love turn a tragedy into something that is beneficial. And I wanted it to be, and I'm working on the second and third book. That's my entry into what you might call the magic fantasy realm. It's magic at a cost, right? So I think that's interesting.
The Voice and the Pendant.
Those were my very earliest. I did a co-collab. Those are children's books, which I find still and always will as maybe the purest form of storytelling, extremely hard to pull off. but those were two entries into a very early series of children's books that, unfortunately, I don't think those are going to continue on. But that was my first foray into writing, which you could say turned me on to the whole rest of the game.
So the second one was Trial by Fire. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming those were your first books.
First and second, they were co-written. So I was a co-author on those and had a great time doing that. It was an educational experience to me. It's very hard to write children's books well. It's sort of is that old adage where you know, the long form is easy, short form's hard, short story's harder. poetry's hardest. The shorter you get, the more difficult it is to make an impact. And you just have to, I'd love to get good at that stuff again. But right now I'm too lost in my enormous narratives.
I see you have a degree in English and American literature.
Mm-hmm.
Before you became an author, I mean, I know you took literature. Did you know you were going to go into being an author of books or a newspaper journalist, a columnist? How did you know which field you want to go into?
I didn't know. I didn't know at all. In fact, I went into college as a business major and darn near flunked out. So I had to turn some stuff around real quick. So I flew to the farthest realm from business, which in my mind was literature. And I hit that off really well. I essentially realized that all I ever wanted to do in college was read books and write about books. Now, whether I could write a book, that was another question. But I think the more books that you read, the more you realize that there's not so much separating you from them. Certainly with some life experiences, right? The only difference between like me and people who haven't written books is that they have not physically finished a book. That's it. I mean, they could do it just as well as I could. You get better as you go down the line, but I always say, you know, a writer is simply someone who finished. That's it.
You were born and raised in Denver, Colorado, and you left for a while, then you went back. You're still there now?
Still am. Yeah, I love Denver.
What led you back to Denver?
Well, I think it's mostly family. You know, I worked in, you know, oil and gas out here. You know, as an English major graduating, you actually can't. A little known to most of us, you can't jump right into a lucrative or at least quasi-successful literary career. You have to kind of figure out ways to write for business. So that's what I did. I was a contract writer and a grant writer. I worked for nonprofits. Oil and gas was big out here at the time. Now tech is big out here. You kind of find a way to business write. And then at the same time, keep up your fiction side, if that's the way you want to pursue it.
I was thinking too, you know, because you have the mountains and, you know, the beauty of Colorado. And I'm thinking you might get a lot of your inspirations from your area.
Yeah, we have. I'm a big fly fisherman. We're blessed with some of the greatest gold medal streams in the world here, you know, Roaring Forks and some of these others, and, you know, up in Colorado Springs. And, you know, I talk about thin places where, in a lot of my novels, where you just feel you're like in a spot that is different and is more connected in a different way to a world that's beyond you. And a lot of those for me are on the river. And I think that's sort of part of the appeal for fly fishing for a lot of people. It's just spiritual thing. And so I do love that. And Colorado has some of the best in the world in that. I try to take advantage whenever I can.
Getting back to Follow the Crow, my sister gave me the three-part series of the books. I started with Follow the Crow, but the day she dropped off the books, and I live kind of like a small village, have kind of a farming community, and I have in front of my house a big field. That day where there was 100 crows in the field, you know, nice size crows too. Well, then getting into the book, and there's a part of the book where she's looking at the crow, and I'm at the same time, this crow flies up on my windowsill, and I'm looking at this crow like, okay, what's going on here? You know, then the crow flies off. As I'm reading the book, the crow flew off. I'm like, this is getting even stranger. So I left my living room, went to my sunroom, and sure enough, the crows were flying around my house, you know, and like 100 of them. Well, then I had a psychic on my show. We talk a little bit, and just out of the blue, she says, how's your crow problem?
Mm.
You know, because you always wonder, how does a crow fit in with the Indian, Navajo?
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting, and that's an incredible story, and one that others have told, not quite at that intensity. That must have been insane. We have a lot of, you know, the crow migration hits Colorado in the fall, right when everything is spooky. And we will have hundreds, right? And there's such a like they do caw in a lot of ways, and sometimes, but sometimes they're completely silent, and they sit in those trees. And I strongly believe that they know more than they say.
Well, you know, what got me was that, yeah, when they were sitting in the field, they're very silent. What's this got to do with the book? Maybe it has nothing to do with the book. That's the first time I've seen that many crows at one time in a field.
I would hope and love to think that I have somehow, I somehow sparked some of that. I do think that you're right. And, you know, what's interesting is, so like totems, Native American totems, especially with the Navajo, it's a piece, a representative piece that's linked to a spirit animal, right, that you keep on yourself. And it's very personal. A lot of people, and I write about this in the book, want the cool ones, just like any of us would, you know, the bear or the eagle, something like that, that has sort of a victor definition or a power definition in the Native American lore. But the crow, like you said, it's about change. And in fact, it's not a totally positive omen. But it's not totally negative. Mm-hmm. It just means that something is happening that's big. And that's sort of what I glommed onto with our main character, who goes through a transition of life and death and beyond, and the ultimate change, and how that's represented by a crow. I'm curious, and I often wonder why they decided to attach that to the crow. We all kind of feel it, right? That a crow comes along during certainly a seasonal time of passage. It's a carrion bird, so it comes along during a physical time of passage for animals and people, and certainly in the days when there were wars fought, where the crow was there during that time.
I thought I shared that story because, you know, I'm reading the book and I'm like, I stopped reading it for a couple of days and the crows are gone, and then I started reading the book and the crows come back. I'm like,
I love to hear that, Al. I think that's great. And you know what? In absence of other evidence, I'm going to take credit for that.
But I loved on your website, you had put your writing and publishing tips, you know, because I'm starting my own book. It's been in a process for over a year now, but I don't want to really call it Ghost in the Valley. I want to, like you said, in those tips, sometimes your title of your book can change 6 or 7 times, you know, during the process of your writing. You know, so I want to go through like just basically one story that got me into, you know, the paranormal, one that affected me.
Yeah, I don't let anyone know what that title is going to be, because they'll have an input. I'll tell you that right now. Uh-huh. What I always just try to just reinforce with writers who are trying to publish. First of all, you have the opportunity to do that better than any time in the history of the world. So that's great. But second of all, I think people are afraid that once they put a thing out there, it's set in stone, like it's a commandment and Moses brought it down and that's it. And you never can change it. You never can update it. That's not the case these days. You can come in and change and update. In fact, that I'm going through a solid rewrite of that entire tournament series, having a great time doing it. I wrote those books coming up on 15 years ago, right? And I had a great mind for it, but I was not great in execution in a lot of ways. And I wanted to go back and kind of comb through them and bring them up to snuff. And that's something you can totally do now. I'm just happy that we live in an era where you can be published and heard and rewrite. And that's something that you can do yourself.
So like you said, was finishing the book, finish what you started.
Mm-hmm. That's one of my tips. A writer, somebody who finishes. It doesn't matter if you strive for perfection, you're never going to finish. And rarely is that saying that perfect is the enemy of good more true than in writing. You just, at some point, you got to let it go. You know, you see people that just pour over one book for 50 years and try to perfect it. That's just not, in my mind, the way that you reach readers anymore. Readers are very forgiving. What they want to see is a great story and an effort at continuation. That's it. And they will give you the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I've heard people say, well, if there's more than 3 typos, your whole book's destroyed. I am living proof that that is not the case. I have mine professionally edited. They're come through multiple times. Stuff slips through. It doesn't matter. It's okay. Just get it out there.
Are you a fan of letting people read what you're writing before it's done or waiting till it's done?
No, I don't do that. My wife.
Mm-hmm. She's your biggest critic.
Yes, she's that's about it. And she's very good at that. But no, I have my editors that I work with because people will chip in for change. Uh-huh. And it just gets you, it kicks you back in the process and keeps you from that finish line.
So do you believe in self-publishing or going with a publisher?
I've done both. I've been hybrid published. I was published by an Amazon imprint and then I've self-published. I believe that self-publishing is the way to go. It's hard to find an audience if you're not established, right? But the speed with which you can work and the resources that you are given are on par with anything that you would get at a traditional house. So like the editors that edit for traditional houses also freelance for self-publishers. Uh-huh. The cover artists that work for traditional houses also freelance for self-publishers. The traditional advertising methods and that traditional houses use are also available to self-publishers, or if not those like New York Times placements, you have something much more powerful in, you know, Facebook or Amazon or some of these social media platforms. You can reach way more people. I was having more success promoting my books that were, you know, quote unquote, traditionally or hybrid published. I had more success promoting them myself than I ever did with the publisher's promotions. It's just changed. And I think that no one looks, when you try to buy a book, no one looks at who published it. They look at the cover, the blurb, the title, the reviews. They don't care who actually, if it was Houghton Mifflin or if it was, you know, any of these others, Penguin, they don't care. Or if it was Jack Black's house of publishing.
Well, I'm going to congratulate you on your tens of thousands of books you've sold worldwide. That's a heck of an accomplishment.
Yeah, thank you. I've been at this game for a long time trying to figure out how to make a living, and I'm almost there. I think that at some point you just got to understand that you're sacrificing a little for the love of what you do. You know, I threw my hat in the ring back way, way long time ago, lost money for a decade, figuring it all out still. But I recall somebody saying when I figured out that I had sold that many of my books over 20 years or so, somebody said, "You realize that that's like more than a football stadium. Think about a football stadium of people reading your books." Uh-huh. And that kind of put it in perspective that I'd accomplished sort of a life goal there. But some of these household names that you may hear, like you'd assume that they're extremely wealthy. They're very much not. They'll make 5% royalty on the book that they sell because the contracts have been sold down the river from agencies to publishing houses to various other areas. And the other thing that self-publishing makes extremely clear is that depending on your what you charge, I mean, 70% goes to you, which is like unheard of in a traditional publishing contract. And is in fact like the way that all these major public like authors are trying to claw back their rights from houses because they realize that if they had been able to put them out themselves, they would be making like orders of magnitude more cash. Yeah, it just comes down to, and this is a big theme, I think, across the spectrum right now with artists is getting paid fairly for what you do. And they're working with that like on Spotify and all these streaming services, certainly with musicians, but also with writers.
Yeah, you definitely want to get paid for what the work you do and the hard work you put into it. What do you have coming up? Anything in the works?
Yeah. So, well, I'm doing a complete re-release of the tournament series, which was my original one that put me on the map. A complete re-release and a complete rewrite of all four books. I just published Blue Fall again. I cut out a lot of chaff. Some readers that have been there from the beginning will have the unique opportunity of seeing basically a book cut in half. And I'm curious to hear from those readers as to whether or not they think I maintained the spirit. And I think I did. I just think I made it tighter and faster and better. So I'm re-releasing all four of those, but net new, the next thing I'm focusing on is book four of the Vanished series.
Awesome.
Which will, that will focus on all the main characters and in a way that I have truly envisioned this character arc as a 6-book series. So I have 3 more in there that I'm going to write. And I'm hoping that the ending brings everybody to tears. That's always a good sign.
So the next one will be the ending?
Nope. The next one's book one of the next 3. So book 4 of 6. I'm going to do the next 3, I think, back to back to back very quickly. So it's going to be a 6-book series, which is crazy for me.
You're talking about the Vanished series, right?
Yeah. So I've got these first 3, and then I'm going to write the last 3. And I've never gone that deep in a series. The characters and the story and the background is just got so much to say that I'm excited to jump back in there. Every couple times when I write these books, I got to go back to Santa Fe and to the New Mexico desert because I think I get connected there, or unplugged, which is what I think we all need today.
Right. You know, my sister, you know, who gave me your book, I have to give her a shout out, Carla Davies, because she's the one that turned me on to your books.
I do too. Thank you, Carla Davies.
Yeah, she was a huge, huge fan of your books. And I thought she was excited when I told her I had you come on the show. I had to give her a shout out.
That's great. Thank you, Carla.
Where can people contact you or get your books, learn more about what's going on?
Yeah, I would just go to my website, bbgriffith.com. I've got a very active area there where I can be reached, and I try to respond to every single person that contacts me, whether or not they think I've done things wrong or right, and you get every sort of thing. I try to respond within 24 hours, and just because my readers are the most important, and they're the whole reason that I'm able to do what I can do. That's where I'd start.
Well, Brad, I want to thank you for being on the show today, and it's been my honor.
Thanks, Al. I really appreciate this. This has been an awesome time, and thanks for reaching out.
I want to thank B.B. Griffith for being my guest today. I suggest you pick up his books because they are very good, every one of them. And I'll put his links at the bottom of this podcast. After my conversation with Mr. Griffith, I had another encounter with a crow. While picking up the book again, I was starting the 3rd book of the Vanish series, The Coyote Way. I took about a week break from reading the books because of the crow experience. And as soon as I started reading the book, a big black crow sat outside my door and was looking at me again. I mean, I don't know if this is a coincidence or something's up with this book, but they are awesome books to read. And check out his books at the link at the bottom of this podcast. I'm your host, Dow Cooley, Ghosts in the Valley Podcast.